All right, guys, look, we know what this is. It's my pre-show pitch to try to convert more free first-hour listeners to full two-hour-plus show subscribers. And this is a format I've been using for 10 years now, so I realize that most people who see the value have already pulled the trigger on it, but now I'm trying to get deep down into those hard-to-reach places, and I guess that's you. Now, what can I say that hasn't been said? There's only a few ways a podcast works. The big one is ads. They suck, they ruin the flow of the show, and in a lot of cases, they erode the trust and respect I have for hosts that go this route. They shouldn't be promoting boner pills and hair pills or encouraging a fast track through the therapy pipeline just because they're getting paid. I've seen nutritionalists break down some of these ingredients in the athletic health powders and drinks, and surprise, they're not as good as they claim to be. I bought a razor my favorite podcaster said would be nick-proof, nicked myself the first day. I got sucked into a foam mattress from a guy who said he's never slept better, and I haven't slept good since. And that Irish titles thing everyone was selling turned out to be a complete scam too. But enough about how my colleagues' mouths are for sale to whoever asks. I'm here to put you in this Plus membership today. 5 shows a month for $8 with a decade-long archive. And yes, the first hour is important. It's there to present our guests to the wide, counterculture, open-minded audience we've cultivated, and it gives people a feel for if they like what THC is, as well as being the proof of concept that I can do a lot more with the added time. The second hour is so I can make a living, and it's also an opportunity to get into the stuff your standard one-hour shows can't, asking guests about that obscure, provocative quote from their book that I actually read, talking about previous work they might have done, getting their thoughts on some odd subject outside of their latest material, or maybe even talking about something too spicy to be out there in the open. And that should appeal to anyone who enjoys the first hour. And when you become a Plus member, these full episodes are all there in a single 2-hour file, no switching back and forth or downloading 2 separate halves of the same interview. It's very nice to have it that way going forward, and if you want to go back, unlike most podcast archives that are just a big chronological list, thehighersidechats.com has categories and scrolling displays much like the big streaming services, and it's all optimized for mobile, and you can even download the files for offline listening. Find some old ones you liked and refresh your memory by starting at the beginning or jump in about 50 minutes to hear everything that would be new to you. I'm even going to be pulling 1 free Plus show a month out of the archive and into the free feed to give you an even better sense of what you miss. The on-site comment section is pretty lively, and the rating system is there to let me know the shows Plus people like best. You also get lifetime access to the forum and access to a bonus page of exclusive interviews I've done here and there, bonus content from other shows that I was on, videos from the few live podcasts I've done, and the MP3s of all the THC closing cover songs I've had made. But that's not all, folks. Plus members also get a discount code for THC merch, a lot of great artwork of aliens, summoning rituals, Hollow Earth maps, and a wide range of wild stuff put on shirts, coffee mugs, pillows, yada yada yada. But it's the ongoing, full interviews people want, and it's convenience that they need. Well, I know 90% of listeners are in a podcasting app right now, so at the top of the show notes, there are the sign-up links. The form is quick and easy, and THC Plus has an RSS feed like any other show, and it can be used with all the big podcasting apps too. I've got support documents and real, non-bot people to help you if you need it, but it's been made as easy as it can be, and you get a 7-day free trial to make sure I'm right. At least meet me there. I also have a Patreon link at the top of the show notes, which I don't love. I'd rather not have a middleman between us when we could be dancing cheek to cheek, but they are a Spotify partner, and a lot of people choose Spotify to listen to THC. So I wanted to make sure they could use it for Plus also, while they let us. The show notes also give you my P.O. box for cash, checks, or business-to-business bartering, as well as all the crypto addresses, because anything is better than nothing. And I want the Plus shows to be heard any way they can be. Just offer me some kind of exchange, you know? This is the job I work at. And I use this example a lot, but a waiter gets an $8 tip for walking the most forgettable meal of your life from the kitchen to the table, and you don't get anything extra for your $8 either. If what I do here isn't at least worth that, is it even worth your time? Hey, I don't like doing this part of the job, but I owe it to my family now to suck it up and make my case while I can, because who knows how long this can last. I'm not some Hollywood millionaire trying to appear genuine through a focused, grouped podcasting venture cycling through all the other celebrities in the agency. I'm just a regular guy who had to make myself valuable when the working world didn't think I had anything to offer. And I hope the first free hour proves that the full experience is worth the price. If we don't like the ad revenue-based world we're living in, then we have to support people who dare to do it a different way, who provide us something interesting, entertaining, and hopefully useful. Outside of that, I just ask that you support the guests who resonate with you, or at least let them know you appreciated what you heard. And that's it. We can get on with the show. And we'll let the rest of the podcasting world pretend there's no better way to do it than disingenuously hyping up any product that cuts them a check while we do our own thing. Meet me on the plus side. The water's fine. And enjoy.
The planet's puppet masters almost surely have a plan. There's clearly maybe something there beyond the realm of man. Until we've thoroughly tested every last close-chested view, find the more you think you know, the less you really do. Where would we be without THC? We know the lying to us, just don't know to what degree. Where would we be without THC? The Ironside Chat Show. Greg Carwood and Company.
It's a beautiful day in the neighborhood, Ironside Chatters. From the Sunshine State, I'm Greg Carlwood, and it seems as if so many people are stuck trudging through the mundane requirements of modern society, being dragged through traffic to a meaningless means to make ends meet, sitting through a rotation of circle-jerk Zoom meetings, or feeling as if they aren't much more than a replaceable part in someone else's machine. The demanding requirements of income generation leave little time for anything else but scrolling through some endless digital list of whatever, and munching on a drive-through dinner while we stare ourselves numb enough to semi-sleep until it's time to face another unsatisfying day. Many mistake being busy for being fulfilled, entertainment for true happiness, and employment for meaningful contribution. Our highly sophisticated mousetrap society can keep many of us so stressed, beaten down, and angsty that we don't even ponder the deeper questions of life's meaning, consider that we might have a cosmic role to play, or even explore our own internal dreams and desires. But there is a better way, and we owe it to ourselves and the greater game of life to explore what it might be and how we can better orient ourselves with its insights and meanings with a capital M. And for a cake with those ingredients, there's really only one baker worthy, and that's the ever-insightful Patrick Harper. He's a great writer responsible for such works as Daemonic Reality, A Field Guide to the Other World, The Philosopher's Secret Fire, A History of the Imagination, and The Secret Tradition of the Soul, as well as a partly fictional account of the great work of alchemy, The Mysterious Mercurius, or The Marriage of Heaven and Earth, which might have even been co-authored by Mercurius himself in some strange esoteric way. And Patrick has also written some highly respected novels like The Savory Truffle, The Good People, and The Stormy Petrel. He has been here twice before, once in the much simpler world of 2018, talking about Daemonic Reality, and again with his sister Marilee in 2021, talking about her book, Mystery Big Cats, and he is back to do the dance again. The Daemonic Reality Restorer, Secret Tradition of the Soul Explorer, and Maestro of the Mysteries. Patrick, my man, welcome back once again. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you, Greg. Glad to be back.
Yes, thank you for doing this. I hadn't read Secret Tradition of the Soul until after the last time we talked, and I'm a big fan of how Daemonic Reality, The Philosopher's Secret Fire, and The Secret Tradition of the Soul all overlap and really reinforce each other by pulling together the best ideas of the past and saying, hey, we do get it right sometimes in the West, but we often lose the thread. Is that fair to say?
That's fair to say. Exactly what I was trying to do, yes. I don't really have new ideas. I look to the past and see what we've neglected or forgotten.
It works. A curator of good ideas. That's how I think of myself sometimes.
Good man.
Well, how would you consider the later two books related beyond this summary where you write, I have documented the extraordinary and fertility-bearing floods that inaugurated those great flowerings of culture among the Renaissance magi, the romantic poets, and the depth psychologists in my book, The Philosopher's Secret Fire. Now I will describe the personal implications of this secret tradition for us as individuals.
Well, yes.
It seems to say it right there, but I guess for people listening, The Philosopher's Secret Fire is more of the overview of the mysteries itself. And then the secret tradition of the soul really boils it down to what it means to the average person.
Yes, I think that's exactly right. You know, the secret fire was an attempt to sort of outline what I think of as the imaginative tradition, but it's also the tradition of soul, if you like, deriving from the Neoplatonists. And it's a tradition which has, for long stretches of our 2,500-year history, remained hidden or occluded or occult. And I wanted to draw attention to that. And then I realized there were some things I'd left out which were too impersonal. And so I kind of reframed that tradition in a more personal way in my book about the soul, where the emphasis was more on soul and less on imagination. But in some sense, I use those words interchangeably. It's a vexed question. I think of imagination as being the chief faculty of the soul, which is important because for the last, well, certainly since the Enlightenment, you know, the chief faculty of us humans was held to be reason. And that has sort of ossified into a kind of rationalism, which is inimical to soul. But the ancients always thought that imagination was the chief faculty of the soul, and I'm going with that.
I like that, and that is something you rally against a lot, the literalization and over-rationalization of everything that comes with the materialist worldview. We hyper-focus on the things we can see and the physical, and we completely cut out the unseen, and that has a lot of implications for a society and an individual, wouldn't you say?
Yes, indeed, yeah. I mean, I think that in one sense, the secret fire is a long critique of literalism, you know, which I think is one of our most telling modern vices, that we don't think anything is real unless it is literally so. And we lay enormous store by facts, but there's more to life than facts. And earlier cultures, their worldview was primarily metaphorical, poetic, if you like. Or rather, and even better, I would say that their worldview was embedded in a vision that preceded the division of the metaphorical from the literal. It's only in modern times have we distinguished between metaphorical and literal. So, for example, the literal worldview thinks that myths are untrue. They think they're fairy stories, they're made-up stories. Whereas, of course, for traditional cultures, myths are the true stories. They absolutely point to the reality of the human condition. But at the same time, I'm not sure that any traditional culture takes them literally in the way that we suppose that they did. Even in ancient Greeks, the gods were understood not in a literal way. They were understood as real, real as images, but not necessarily literally real. It's a very hard distinction for us to make, because we are so literal-minded. So it's easy for us to dismiss all the products of the imagination as if they were mere fictions. But even now, even in modern times, there's a sense in which we understand that fiction, drama and novels and poetry, can be more real, more truth-telling than so-called facts. So it's not impossible for us to understand this distinction between the literal and the metaphorical. And indeed, it's not impossible for us to understand how those two things might be combined, as it were, or understood before they were split apart at the scientific revolution. Do you see what I mean?
I do. And one of the missions around here is to re-enchant the world, to improve our relationship with soul and light that fire of the imagination back up. And I'm not very good at it, but I love talking to people who do think in those ways, because it is kind of difficult. We've been conditioned one way, and it's really hard to make a switch when there's just this constant drumbeat of materialism, atheism. I mean, this is the way I grew up. It was just like really hard to see anything else. I always enjoyed the mysterious and UFOs and that kind of thing. UFOs, you can kind of shoehorn in because they're from some other planet, this or that. And then you get to a more complex and nuanced understanding of that. And, you know, then we're back to igniting that imagination in the daemonic reality. But I guess to move along here, what would you consider the central tenets of this secret tradition of the soul, or the core components of it, even though the wrapper kind of changes when the current does come up to the surface? There are some core things we could say about it for the uninitiated here so they have a better understanding of the term.
Yes, I suppose that the central tenets are that, first of all, as I said, that soul and imagination are central and are the core faculties by which we apprehend reality. Secondly, absolutely key to the whole business is that following the Neoplatonists, for example, they weren't the only people who believed this, but they were the best articulators of the view that the whole cosmos is made of soul, or is sustained or underpinned or controlled by soul, as Plotinus said, or rather soul stuff, you know, that soul isn't like spirit. It's not inimical to being material. It's both material and non-material. It's a bit like water, which can be both ice, can be solid, as it were, but also fluid, or even ethereal, as in steam, you know, that sort of analogy. And this idea, which was Plato's idea originally, that the whole cosmos had a soul woven through it, was reinterpreted in different ways later on, which I might go into later, i.e. as the romantic imagination, as the collective unconscious, and certainly nowadays as a revival of interest in the idea of consciousness, which is now held by a lot of scientists and idealist philosophers to be the basic substrate and fabric of the universe. But if we stick with the Neoplatonic idea of soul, the idea is that soul is an impersonal principle which constitutes the fabric of the universe, and we are sort of individual manifestations of it. And so that leads us to one of the central doctrines, which is that of the correspondence between the macrocosm and the microcosm, where the macrocosm is the cosmos at large, and the microcosm is us little individual cosmoses. And so there is a kind of resonance between, and affinity between, us and the cosmos, that we're not separate from it. We're just differentiated portions of the whole cosmic soul. And so that we remain intimately connected to the outside world, to nature, and indeed to the larger cosmos. I think that those are the main ideas, I think.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so the Neoplatonists would be a good place to look for an area where that current peaked. I'm curious about some others. I mean, especially outside of the West, you write about some traditional or indigenous tribes that do live closer to nature, and they have really complex models for reality, way more than one might think, because they don't have the scientific method and all this stuff. But a lot of it is observation and just being embedded in the environment. We've taken ourselves out of the environment. We do all our experimentation in an isolated, sterilized laboratory. And that's not how nature works. You can't really take out parts of the whole and then get some great insight that's applicable out in the real world, out in the chaos of everything. But talk to us about some of the cultures outside of the West and your favorite takeaways from studying their thoughts on the soul and the insights you get from their models.
Yes, I mostly draw on what the anthropologists call animist cultures. And they believe explicitly that everything has a soul. And so they relate to everything in a subjective manner, because they recognize that they themselves are only one manifestation of soul. But all animals, all trees, all natural objects are themselves in soul. So you have a kind of subjective relationship to them, and these relationships have to be very, very carefully managed. For instance, if you're hunting, which is, you know, absolutely a key thing in hunter-gatherer tribes, it's an extremely perilous activity because you're killing something like a brother or a sister, because you're both ensouled beings and you don't necessarily have priority over them. So you have to be very careful how you kill them. You have to kill very respectfully. You have to not mention the name of the animal you're killing, because it's, you know, if you kill a bear in the Arctic Circle, you have to say, you know, I have acquired a brother or something like that. They use all these careful euphemisms so as not to, as it were, blaspheme against the natural order. So that's very interesting to me. And it seems to me that having read more anthropology recently, I was very surprised to discover, I read a very interesting book called Beyond Nature and Culture by a Frenchman called Philippe Descola, who's sort of head of the Anthropological Institute or whatever it's called in Paris. Very hard to read because, you know, it's French, he's an intellectual. But he surprised me by announcing that there are only four possible worldviews. You know, I thought there were probably as many worldviews as there were people. But he thinks not, and he knows what he's talking about. And I've read critiques of him which don't really question this assertion of his. And the four worldviews are animism, totemism, analogism, and naturalism. Naturalism is simply our modern worldview after the scientific revolution, which began, well, at the Renaissance, but took off in the 17th century and was crowned at the Enlightenment. Totemism is a special case. It's mostly found in Australia. All Australian tribes are totemists, but the word totem comes from the Plains Indians of America. So obviously they have a totemistic element in their culture, but they are all basically animists. But the fact that they have a totemic element in their culture means that there's always going to be overlap between these worldviews. And indeed, I'm a living example of an overlapping worldview, that I'm partly animist, partly naturalist, modern, but perhaps favorite, I'm an analogist. And now, analogism is the worldview that the Chinese used to have, the Aztecs used to have, the Indians used to have, and still do. And what Europe had before the scientific revolution. And it was based on the idea, well, it's, animism was probably the earliest worldview. I mean, it's still going in Amazonia and in, you know, certain parts of the world, the Arctic Circle particularly. But I have a feeling that animism was probably the earliest worldview as well. You know, the hunter-gatherers of Neolithic times and before, we don't really know what they believed, but I suspect they were animists. So analogism came a bit later on. It's very much the idea of, as expressed by the alchemists, that what goes on above is reflected in the below, that everything is analogous. In Europe, there was a great chain of the European cosmos before the scientific revolution, thought that creation was a great chain of being which stretched from God through the angels, nine orders of angels, down to man, down to animals, down to plants, down to stones. So there was a kind of a vertical structure. But at each level could be thought of horizontally and was analogous to the level above it. So, for example, the idea of the top human was the king, and the analogy amongst the animal world was the lion, and amongst the plant world was the rose, and so on. And someone like Shakespeare uses that kind of imagery all the time. The chief metal was gold, you know, and so on and so forth. The top planet was the sun, planet, in inverted commas, because, you know, we were thought to be the center of the universe then. So all these systems of analogies, all these different planes of existence were analogous to each other. So the whole universe was extremely orderly and harmonious, everything connected to everything else, and everything ensouled in an animistic way. Nothing was just a thing or an object or inanimate. Even stones were thought to have some dim kind of soul life to them. And I find that a very attractive idea. And I think it's borne out by our own experience at times. Like, for instance, when we experience synchronicities, for example. I mean, that would be just a commonplace thing in the analogist view of the world, because what happens within you as a soul is reflected in the larger world soul around you, and vice versa. So there was a lovely concordance or resonance between, you know, the human mind and the outside world. And so an image in the mind would find a resonance outside, and vice versa, which made for a very meaningful universe. You know, everything was harmonious, unified, bound together, and yet every level was distinct and discriminated between. You know, there was no conflation of things, you know.
Yeah, I like it. I think that does make sense, that although it seems like there's 1,000 worldviews, they usually can be put into one of the four buckets. And in terms of the point of a human life, I liked this paragraph. You say, many West African peoples believe that before you enter the world, you draw up a contract with a heavenly double who prescribes what you will do with your life, how long you'll live, who you'll marry, how many children you'll have, and so on. Then, just before you're born, you are led to the tree of forgetfulness, which you embrace. And from that moment, you lose all conscious recollection of your contract. However, if you do not live up to your contractual obligations, you will become ill and you will need the help of a diviner who will use all of his skill to make contact with your heavenly double and discover which articles of the contract you are failing to fulfill. I love stuff like that. It seems well thought out and pretty accurate from what I can tell about what life seems to be. It's another one of those big buckets that many cultures have something similar to that. But it is an odd structure to make such a plan, forget it, and then face consequences for not remembering. I understand when you go down this rabbit hole and start doing the thought tree, well, you can't come into the world with the knowledge, or the whole adventure doesn't work. So there's these like subtle hints at what it is, but it would be much better if we lived in a society that taught us how to recognize those subtle hints or the symbology of life. And maybe when you look at America and everybody's obese with chronic illness and there are no shamans to visit, just the white lab coat pill pushers, I can see why our society is so ill. But talk to us about those mechanisms. I mean, the idea of a otherworldly double, a soul contract, and that our life's purpose is to fulfill such a contract. It's not just the West African people that think that.
No, indeed. One of the reasons for my writing the Soul Book was to expound at greater length the idea of the personal daimon. I'd referred to it in Daimonic Reality, but I hadn't really explored it. And as a result of reading more anthropology, it sort of was borne in upon me more and more that this was a very, very common belief. You know, I was finding it in all sorts of tribes, this idea that we are shadowed by a kind of double. And the West Africa description you've just read out, it is almost exactly the same as the description in Plato of the personal daimon. And it occurs in his great work, The Republic, in which he tells the story of a man called Ur, who died but came back to life. He had what we call a near-death experience. And tells us the mechanics of how it works in the afterlife, and that, you know, you die and you return to the fullness of being that you were denied on earth, but you are reincarnated. And this happens, you're given the choice of a life. You can choose the life you want. There's a whole sort of pool of lives, you know, and you choose the one you want. And once you've chosen it, you are assigned a personal daimon whose job is to help you to enact that life, to unfold that life when you're born on earth. And the personal daimon became the guardian angel of Christianity later on, which is still widely and very properly believed in. Its role is to guide you, is to help you fulfill your life plan. It's the guardian of the blueprint of your life. And also to protect you, you know, so guiding and protecting you. The West African description is even more detailed and I think probably more accurate. So I began to take this idea, which hadn't really occurred to me before, more seriously. And I thought, yes, how true it was of my own life. You know, one felt impelled by some daimonic force to do certain things, even against my own wishes or desires or, you know, whatever. You don't necessarily do what you want or what you think is good for you. The daimon, and with its divine plan for your life, has its own scheme of what you should be doing. And I think we've lost, with this evidence too from around the world, sometimes the personal daimon is seen as an ancestor who is assigned to you at birth. That's quite a common thing. For instance, above the Arctic Circle, the Inuits believe in. For instance, a child isn't given a name until it's divined which ancestor is its daimon, is its personal guardian. And then it's named after that ancestor. And so it's a common idea and one that I find very fruitful. It's not fatalistic. I think it's a kind of fate, but fate isn't the same as fatalism. Things aren't predetermined. There's a lot of wiggle room, but nevertheless, there is a kind of blueprint for our lives, which we have chosen ourselves before we were born, and which we then forget, and the daimon helps us unfold it. And one of the particularly attractive ideas for me is the notion that if that's the case, there's a sense in which we are drawn towards our personal destiny from the future, as it were, from the plan that's already laid down. And our job is to unfold that plan, to enact it and to make it concrete, to actualize it. In other words, you know, we're not necessarily determined, as psychoanalysis would say, by our past, by whatever happened to us as children or what bad parenting we had or what traumas we had. No, we are rather drawn towards our destiny from the future, from the completed self that the daimon already has in its mind. And so the daimon, you know, directs our soul in this way, that the world is, as John Keats said, is the veil of soul making, that we have souls, but in some sense we also have to make them, that we are acorns that have to become oaks, that we are potentials which have to be actualized. And that is the key to the meaning of our lives. I mean, that's where the meaning of our lives comes from. And if we deny the promptings of the daimon, you know, it's the worse for us. And indeed, you know, it should be the role of psychotherapy, really, to help us to contact our daimons. You know, as your West African passage said, if you lose contact with your daimon, with your double, you start to get ill, you know, and the witch doctor is called in to help you reestablish contact with it and so on. And psychotherapy is, the people's chief ill is that kind of loss of contact with the daimon which directs and guides and protects their soul. And so, you know, a psychotherapist is like a witch doctor in that respect, and should be concerned not so much with analyzing your past and worrying about this and that, but helping you to reestablish contact with your own daimyo. And then things can proceed, you know. Of course, you know, I mean, being aware of your daimyo or aware of your purpose doesn't mean you're going to be happy, because your destiny, your fate may be to suffer all sorts of tribulations. And in any case, we can't avoid that. We're all subject to pathologies. We're all subject to loss and bereavement and grief, you know, and fear. So we're not necessarily happy. But what our lives are fuller if we obey the Diamond's blueprint, we know that we're on the right track. Our life has meaning and purpose.
Mm-hmm. Well said. So yes, I really like that description of the personal diamond and the contract that we have. Another thing I like in your books is that you talk about the idea that on top of this contract and the personal liaison that helps us try to fulfill it, we can also be ruled by someone in the big pantheon of gods. One of them is always sort of driving our actions or our mindset. Talk to us about this idea and how we can determine what God might be acting through us or what God rules us and how we could even shift to another, or if that's even something that's in our hands.
Yes, I know that's a vexed question, but in this matter, I'm following James Hillman, who was perhaps the best of the post-Jungian depth psychologists. I mean, he accepted, as I do, I think, that there are archetypes at work in our unconscious, that somehow or other, we are ruled by sort of archetypal forces. And Jung had a whole pantheon of archetypes, the anima and the animus and the wise old man and the eternal youth and the great mother and the self and so on. But these were really, I think Hillman thought this, and I do too, that they were kind of reinventions or repackagings of traditional gods. Principally, for example, the gods of Greek mythology, because Greek mythology has been so influential in our culture. And also, it's incomparably rich, the mythology of the Greeks. You know, it's fantastically rich, fantastically well documented. So there may well be deities other than Greek deities, of course, who are ruling our lives, Anglo-Saxon gods for the English, for example, but we have almost no information about Anglo-Saxon gods. I tend to think that the Norse gods play a much larger part in Northern European psychology than is generally thought, that we may well be sort of more Norse god-oriented than Greek god-oriented. But nevertheless, even the Norse gods and the Greek gods have a lot in common. You know, you can see a lot of parallels between Thor and Zeus, between Odin and Hermes and so on. So the kind of point is rather moot. Granted that archetypes play a large part in influencing our lives unconsciously, so that we're not aware of them, I think it's even more fruitful to think of them as gods, because the gods are more fully described and elaborated in the mythologies than the Jungian archetypes are, since, you know, they were discovered by him alone. It is by definition very difficult to know which god is ruling you or influencing you or forming your worldview over and above the personal daimon, simply because that is the world we are in, as it were. That we can't, as it were, see, it's like seeing your own eyeball. If you're in the grip of, let me give an example, materialism as an ideology, which claims that all things are only matter. It's quite, well, as the root word of materialism from the Latin mater, meaning mother, suggests, the goddess behind materialism is the great mother. And someone like Zeus's wife, Hera, who was very single-minded, believed that, you know, only one thing was real at a time, just as materialists do. They only believe in one thing. It's a kind of ideology that believes that only matter is real. And incidentally, she's very, very jealous of other perspectives on the world. For example, when her husband goes off and has sex with nymphs or other goddesses, she's insanely jealous. That points to the way in which materialists can't abide any other kind of perspective, any other kind of divine plan. Let me give you another example. Think of the way in which women were enjoined to be good little housewives in the 1950s. Well, you can see that they are under the influence then, or rather that way of looking at women was under the influence not of Hera, but of her daughter Hebe, who was a classic good little servant housewife and so on. And we can see that the trouble begins when Zeus gives birth to Athena, and Athena isn't born in the conventional way. She springs from his head, fully armed. And we can see in her the feminist, you know, the shift from the view of women as housewives to the view of women as strong, independent women. They come from Zeus's head, i.e. they're a product, they're intellectual, but they're from his thought. And they're fully armed, which means they're already up and running to be combative, you know. Very different from other women who are under the influence of Aphrodite, for instance, who's the goddess of love. You might say free love, promiscuity, you know, sex. So all these goddesses, and of course they don't just underpin women, they underpin men as well, but that takes a different form, you know. There's no sexism in the world of mythology. The gods and goddesses influence all of us, regardless of our gender.
Sure, yes. And the heavy Aphrodite examples are in the book when you talk about deities behind social movements and different eras. And I'm curious, you know, when you look in the past, with hindsight, it's a little easier to sometimes see, but I'm curious what gods you see at play in today's social movements or the major arcs of our timeline. And could we nudge ourselves in a different direction that might better serve our collective society? But what forces do you see at play today?
I'm too close to it. We all are. We're too close really to get leverage on it. I think that the major competitor with the wonderful diversity and of Greek polytheism was, of course, Christianity. And that is more important as a mythic background to, for example, Americans than Europeans, because the founding fathers were exiled Puritans. You know, the grand plan of American society was Northern Protestant Puritanism, who were all escaping persecution in Europe. And so I have a feeling that there is this strong Puritan streak in the American psyche. I'm leaving aside the diversity of your ethnic differences and so on, but the grand plan of the American psyche was a Puritan. And I see that resurging very much in the single-minded ideologies which have overtaken most of the English-speaking world. The trouble with ideologies is that they're like religion gone wrong. Fundamental Christians, fundamentalist Christians, for instance, are Christians who've been captured by an ideology. The ideology being the religion of one book, the Bible, which is taken completely literally. So it's quite a narrow kind of view. The attraction of ideologies is exactly that, that it is one thing. It's simplistic in a way. All ideologies are simplistic. They concentrate on one thing, which rules everything else. For example, the idea of class in Marxism, the class war. You know, and it's a very compelling idea that all evils can be put down to differences in class and the exploitation of one class by another. There's obviously truth in it, otherwise it would never catch on. But it's then used to explain just about everything. And that is itself a kind of puritanical idea, because the Puritans excluded everything. They didn't want anything to do with soul. We didn't want anything to do with beauty, dance, theatre, drama, art, images. The Puritans cut all that out. They wanted everything bare, stark, imageless, you know, just people working hard in an ethical way. Of course, that is a very compelling idea too. I think we should work hard and be ethical, but you know what I mean? When it's confined to that alone, it excludes so much. So it's no longer, I mean, the ruling idea is no longer class. It's probably today race. That's probably the single most telling ideology. And to attribute everything to race is obviously faulty. Well, not obviously, but, you know, it is obvious to me.
Right. It is hard for us to incorporate many different things. And you're right. Ideologies are attractive because you kind of get to shut off your mind and say, okay, I found it. This is the answer. And now everything gets filtered through this lens. I see it happen in my own audience. When I interview one guest versus another guest, people will latch on and say, no, that resonated with me. And now that's my new worldview. And now I'm shut off from other interpretations of what the UFO might be and that sort of stuff. And I try to keep, you know, even if we're leaning this direction, let's still give some space to someone who still thinks that the alien bodies are at Wright-Patterson. I don't know. But another thing you say in the book, in The Secret Tradition of the Soul, is that the shaman appears whenever the tribe, people, or culture is threatened with extinction. And that's a provocative idea. I like the thought that there are these mechanisms in place. If you lose contact with your diamond and the contract, well, we got a guy. You need to go see the guy at the edge of the village and he's going to help reconnect you. Or, you know, if there's a more existential threat, we got that too. We got a person in place, a safety mechanism, a lever to pull to try to help you from absolute annihilation and extinction. But do we have a modern Western archetypal shaman? I mean, you would think someone like this might be of a bit of fame, perhaps, but does the absence of such a person, I mean, when I rack my brain, I can't think of anybody. Does the absence of such a person mean that we're maybe less close to extinction than we're led to believe? Or do you see shamans emerging as we're maybe nearing some precipice?
Well, the trouble is that when you talk about the precipice, I suppose you mean for Western culture. The trouble is, it's just too big to be a tribe anymore. I mean, the only figure that stands out as a possible shaman for the tribe of Western culture is the second coming of Christ. I mean, because we are a Christian culture, and the idea that there will be a Messiah that will come and save our whole culture is part of the Christian myth. And that may well be the case. Who knows, you know?
I think there's so many people who don't subscribe to that. It was kind of just stamped on us and we're told we're a Christian nation. We better be somewhat Christian. But I just think there's so many people, especially in this audience, that reject that don't subscribe to it. Obviously, we're colored by it a little bit. It's everywhere around us. But I think so many people listening would be like, I don't buy into that.
No, I agree. I don't buy into it either. What I'm saying is that there is no kind of shaman for the Western world apart from the figure of Christ, you know.
So we're in trouble.
What we have instead is pockets of would-be saviors all over the place, you know. Endless kind of mini shamans, if you like. There are, you know, gurus and teachers and mentors and psychotherapists and everybody forms their own little tribe within Western culture in which it seeks to find salvation. So, you know, there are absolutely masses of these people who follow some sort of artistic vocation, or people who follow some sort of religious belief or some sort of religious sect, or just New Age people who believe in kind of spirituality and so on and so on. It's because our culture is too big. It's very, very fragmented. So, you know, there can't be any more. It's not like, you know, a hunter-gatherer tribe will only number, you know, 80 to 100 people at most, you know. So then you can, in that sort of cohesive society, you can imagine the priest, the shaman, working for all of them, kind of voicing their collective fears and interests and so on.
It's interesting to think about these mechanisms of reality that are baked in and have been baked in from the beginning, but then they just go so haywire, or it's hard to find the thread on how they're applicable to such a connected global society. I think about that all the time when it comes to things like ritual magic and influence and things like egregores. Like, a person like me is not meant to be speaking to 100,000 people right now. I mean, that privilege was reserved for like 0.001% of people for most of the story. And it's just odd to think about how these things work themselves out in a global type of situation. It seems like they're kind of broken, or I don't know how the other world is responding to this connectivity. I would expect to see way more influence from the other world. In the same way I say to people who are big on crystals, I say, well, you know, I got crystals all over the place. Just because, I mean, they're nice to look at. I don't feel the energy of crystals. I don't even feel the energy of crystals when I go into a crystal shop. You would think that the crystal shop would be so explosive in its energy potential that how could a person not feel something going on? They might as well all be red bricks in terms of my energetic sensitivity to them. But as things get bigger, like society, or, you know, concentrations of crystals in a building, I would expect these mechanisms to kind of like really light the fire. Like, how could you possibly deny the other world when these mechanisms, these little things, should be amplified even from that side of things?
What do you expect me to say to that, Greg? You know,
I expect you to solve all my problems.
No, I mean, Western culture has done away with the other world as it's done away with God, you know, and it's a mistake. It's done away with the gods, and the tension between many gods and one God runs through the whole of Western religion and philosophy, the one and the many, and so on. But as you say, it's got very big, we've gone global, and so we have no choice but to fragment and each seek our own. We're now empowered to seek our own path of salvation. That's very liberating. You don't have to be a Christian. You know, you can be anything you want. There's a big candy store out there. You could be a Zen Buddhist, as I was for nearly a fortnight. You know, you could be a communist.
The next Willy Wonka, if you so choose.
Exactly.
Maybe it seems like we've elbowed the other world out of the picture, out of the frame, and it's just kind of quietly waiting to be recognized, or maybe not so quietly, to bring it back to what we talked about last time, that the grays and the abduction phenomenon is a mechanism of the other world and the diamonds to shake people awake and be like, hey, no, we're here, and you're either going to voluntarily engage with us, or we will just do things like this. And what I got out of the secret tradition of the soul is, you talk about shamanism and dismemberment, that dismemberment is such a huge part of that whole motif. And it is. I mean, people who go to the Amazon and do ayahuasca, the trendy thing these days, they're always cut into ribbons by Mother Ayahuasca and then reassembled. And then she's like, that's enough for tonight. We'll see you on the next ritual. And then she rebuilds you. And so that motif is definitely there. And when you think about the grays archetypal story, a lot of it is experimentation, probing, medical type things, extracting fluids. And there is a tendency to literalize it all because we don't even recognize that we have an etheric body or kind of a dream body or astral, whatever. We don't acknowledge that. So we think, oh, that was us. That was my physical self. I was on a physical craft. I was manipulated and my semen extracted, and I'm not happy about it. But, you know, in this wider context, that makes sense. And it is the other side reaching out to be like, you can't ignore us.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, it's the problem with literalism again. We mistake the physical for the literal. But, you know, alien entities can be as physical as they are non-physical, you know, that they are products of the pathology of the soul, you know. What's really being dismembered is our imperious ego point of view, which thinks, you know, that we are absolutely the center of consciousness, and our dismemberment is really the dismemberment of the ego and its literalistic perspective, so that we are willy-nilly, we die to ourselves, as it were. We don't die literally. We die to ourselves. We die to our blindness, our former preconceptions, our worldview. And we are initiated into a completely different worldview, in which the other world of the soul, takes preference. The soul comes back to us. And so we become less egotistical, less self-important, less arrogant, less hubristic. That's the idea. And that's why we all need to be initiated. And indeed, sensibly, all tribal cultures place initiation rites at certain times of a life as an absolute priority. But it's all in the ancient myths, in ancient Egypt. The key god Osiris, he was dismembered and so on and reconstituted. Dionysus in the Greeks was dismembered and reconstituted. Orpheus was dismembered. He was one of the great shaman figures. The musician, the one who has the sacred songs and thereby gets access to the underworld, where his wife, i.e. the symbol of his soul, has died and gone into the underworld, and he retrieves her. And that's a traditional shamanistic task, the retrieving of lost souls. So yes, you know, dismemberment and reconstitution, death and rebirth, is an archetypal structure which we can't get away from. And we seem to have ignored it. And one of the things that makes me most angry is our neglect of, not angry, but, you know, despondent, is our neglect of adolescent children who have no initiation rites. They remain children, except when they initiate themselves, which they feel impelled to do. In gang culture, for instance, which has very strict initiatory rules, you have to show absolute loyalty to the peer group, you have to commit certain violent acts or daring acts or, you know, courageous acts, tremendously rule-bound, you know. You have to wear uniforms and get tattooing and scars, just like traditional tribal initiation rites. But you can't really initiate yourself because you remain within the cohort, within the gang culture. The whole point of initiation is to move you from childhood into wider society, into adulthood, together with other adults and so on. And that's why, you know, when often very violent tribal initiation rites, painful, you're given scars or circumcised, you know, you're starved, you're put in a symbolic grave and left alone, you know, you're beset by daimons and visions, the vision quest of the American Indians. But that's difficult, you know. They're real ordeals, but your reward is that you come out knowing who you are, feeling that you're a man or a woman, you know, proper. You've undergone these tests, you've passed them, and your reward is you enter into the fullness of adult life, and the secret myths of the tribe are revealed to you. You know, all the creation myths are given to you, unfold before you like a great tapestry and so on. We don't have that. I mean, the Christian church had sort of, it used to have kind of token initiation, right? Baptism, confirmation, but they didn't have anything like the severity. All our efforts now seem to be to protect children from any kind of suffering or harm or pain. It's a mistake. Children don't like that. They want a bit of hardship to find out who they are, you know. And that's why brat camps are so successful. You take a lot of spoiled brats, then you make them walk for miles across the desert and build their own fires and cook their own food, and they all cry and wail for 3 days. But, you know, after about 3 days, they like it. They feel they've achieved something and they've overcome hardship, you know, and they stop whining and crying and they get on with it, you know.
Yeah, you can almost see the dismemberment motif playing out in that process, the breaking down and the building up. And I know we're kind of at the end of the line here. Man, you are really one of my favorite people to talk to, even though it is few and far between. I appreciate you doing this once again. We, of course, have to get the plugs in, but I am curious, as we're talking about the things people can do to follow up on your work, if you have any other favorite thinkers or authors that are out there right now, you know, throw them in too, but especially in the Fortean realm, which is a really dwindling, suffocating realm that's really hard to find gems in today. But I wanted to ask you that. But also, you know, of course, tell us about your work and where people can follow up if they like the cut of your jib.
Oh, they could just look me up on Google. My books are all there, you know. You go to my website. It's a rather primitive website, but I have some interesting articles I've published on it, which were all written for Fortean times, you know, but I've put them up on my website, things like that. As for, I don't read many modern books, too many. 80% of my reading is novels. That's what I am. I'm a novelist. I'm not a philosopher or a thinker or an intellectual, you know. I like a good story. And I think my nonfiction books are a bit like novels in that I tell a lot of stories in them, you know. Daimonic reality is full of stories from the other world, you know, wonderful things. And my interpretations, you know, well, I mean, you can take them or leave them. I think having a sense of wonder is the main object, really, you know. I think people should read more Jung, and they should read more Hillman, and they should read more Henri Corbin, who was a great exponent of imagination. He made popular the word imaginal, for the in-between realm between this world and the other world. The mundus imaginalis, the imaginal world, which is now passed into popular currency. And if you can't read Corbin, because he's quite difficult and is dealing with medieval Sufi culture, then you can read Tom Cheatham, who's written a lot of books about Corbin and tells us what's in them. And that was my shortcut. There's probably lots of others, but mostly I'd urge people, you know, to read more fiction, good fiction, read proper novels and poetry and drama. You know, I can't tell you how much I got out of the plays of Henrik Ibsen. You know, I think he's the greatest tragedian since Shakespeare, you know. I'm sorry that more people don't read literature of that kind, because I think in the end that's much more nourishing and rewarding than reading endless non-fiction books full of ideas and theories and so on, all of which are, I don't know, not as rich, not as satisfying. Go back to the arts, for God's sake.
Fair enough.
Read my novels, forget the non-fiction.
Yeah, the good people. I hear good things. I need to get into it.
Yeah, nobody's read that yet, yeah.
Well, hey, I appreciate you most as a curator of good ideas, so I had to ask about other things that you had read and other places to look for insight and stuff, but I'm just a big fan of the nonfiction work you do. It's always a big part of my job, because it's hard for me to extract knowledge from fiction in a way that works for this kind of show. So your nonfiction work really is useful for me. But yeah, I love it. It's been an honor and a pleasure. Thanks for spending the time with me once again, and take care out there.
Love you, Greg. I enjoy your shows.
Oh, thank you. I try.
So it's great. Okay, though. Bye-bye for now. We'll meet again in another life.
Indeed.
Okay.
And boom goes the dynamite, the ever humble and insightful Patrick Harper. Kind of him to say he listens to THC once in a while. I take that as a big badge of honor because I'm a huge fan of his books, and having now read another one, I see why you might say it's like a trilogy or a three-part series. There are huge overlapping areas because these topics all bleed over into each other. So it's like holding up one grand mystery and looking at it from three different angles. Like I said in the beginning, he's a great curator of good ideas. He mines the past and pulls out the gems and gives his own personal take, just really through the examples that he chooses to highlight. Clearly, I have an affinity for that approach. It's how I try to go about this show, at least play the part of being neutral in an interview, because it's just a better way to do interviews. And it's not hard to get a good idea of what I think is interesting and has merit just by who and what I'm highlighting through the nature of guest selection. But I had a good time with this. I hope you agree. I love the incorporation of indigenous models. He was doing that before it was cool. I like how he talks about the Western mind and the difficulty we have processing these other trains of thought sometimes. I like how he talks about mystery as not something to be solved, but something to be engaged with. Just a lot of good stuff. And I really do feel like if you read his three books, Daemonic Reality, Philosopher's Secret Fire, and Secret Tradition of the Soul, and you find them convincing, you end up with a pretty well-developed and likely accurate and detailed model for life, death, cryptids, UFOs, the nature of things, and all the stuff we talked about today. I still struggle with how something so fundamental, so influential to and for our reality could also be so subtle as to be deniable. I guess the premise, though, is that if you don't engage with any of it, it will just leave you alone. Clearly not true for the abductees, but, you know, in general, we're saying. But if you do decide to explore it through half a dozen different avenues, you will get a response pretty reliably. And many guests have said that, whether they're magic practitioners or entheogen users. If you don't go to the shaman, shamanic things won't happen. I guess it's as simple as that. And I personally have gotten enough to know it's real. But sometimes you think you just want more, or you want a reconfirmation of the things that have gotten fuzzy in your mind. But either way, I'm glad Patrick was willing to do this again. Fun stuff to think and talk about. A great birthday present to myself, I guess, is releasing a good episode, and to me, this definitely qualifies. And on the subject of qualifying as a good episode, let's look at the review score from Plus members for the last show with Walter Bosley. I was a little unsure. It's unique stuff, it's obscure, but to me, some of the best episodes I've ever done are the ones I consider classics. They're the ones that are often about pretty obscure, unknown threads where we just really get into the minutiae of things and try to give all the details that present a clear case or a full, complete story. Oftentimes, those ones become my favorites, and I am not alone. A 4.9. Unbelievable. You just don't see that very often, folks. Big happy birthday to me indeed. That is right, guys. Working on my birthday. So dedicated, 39 years young, hard to believe I'm almost 40, I certainly don't feel it. When I started this show, I felt like one of the cool things was being so young, when it really was mostly older guys, and now I'm almost 40. It's nuts. But yes, releasing what I consider another good show, coming off a high like that, a 4.9, things are good. I really cannot complain. All I want for my birthday is for everything to keep going how it's going, really, in all areas of life. And for you to treat yourself to THC Plus. How about that? Who asks people to get themselves something for their own birthday? I think a selfless gesture like that should be rewarded. But we will see. Big thanks again to Patrick. Let's take a look at the meetup calendar. Look at that. THC meetups as far as the eye can see. March 30th, we have one at Fieldhouse Brewing. Abbotsford, British Columbia, Canada. April 4th, the Flame International Restaurant in LA. April 6th, Tallahassee, Florida. April 8th, Huntington, Indiana. And Carbondale, Illinois. April 12th, Golden, Colorado. April 13th, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. April 20th, London. Hey, that's 420. Would you look at that? And we'll end it there. But lots of stuff happening. Go meet some new friends based on a mutual love of weird stuff covered on THC. It's nice to know more locals. It's nice to have a network. Go to HiresideMeetups.com for more details if you heard of a location near you, or go make your own. It's free, it's easy, very low risk, and potentially very high reward. But that's it for me. Very happy with this one. Also very happy with the next two I have recorded, and both very different subjects. Again, life is good. I know that the foundations of our society are quite shaky, but I feel like someone somewhere has been saying that for most of my life. And yeah, there's clearly always strikes and gutters, but it's never really been a match for the hyperbole and the fear and the panic that I'm usually hearing about. But I hope a lot of you feel that same way, that things maybe aren't as bad for you personally as they seem for the wider culture out there. That means we're winning, I think. Hard to say anymore. But again, loved it. Take care of you and yours. I'm getting out of here. I've done my part. Your move, demonic reality deniers, secrets of the soul keepers, and agents of the other world. Your fucking move.
Woke up this morning with light in my eyes, and then realized it was dark outside. It was a light coming down from the sky. I don't know who or why. Must be those strangers that come every night, whose saucer-shaped light put people uptight. Leave blue-green footprints that glow in the dark. I hope they get home all right. Hey, Mr. Spaceman, won't you please take me along? I won't do anything wrong. Hey, Mr. Spaceman, won't you please take me along the high side. Woke up this morning, I was feeling quite weird. I had flies in my beer, my toothpaste was smeared. I opened my window, they'd written my name. We'll see you again. Hey, Mr. Spaceman, won't you please take me along? I won't do anything wrong. Hey, Mr. Spaceman, won't you please take me along the high. Take me along the high side.